supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Two longtime New Jersey radio hosts are now apologizing for their racist comments about the state's attorney general. Yesterday, Dennis Malloy and Judy Franco of New Jersey 101.5 said this about New Jersey Attorney General Grewal for practicing sick.
You know, the attorney general, the guy, I'm never going to know his name. I'm just going to say the guy with the turban.
Okay.
The new attorney general?
Turban man.
Yeah, turban man. Hey, okay. Listen, and if that offends you, then don't wear the turban man. I'll remember your name.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports that while many have criticized the radio hosts for the insult, some of the station's listeners say it was blown out of proportion.
Sim Singh is a senior manager at the Sick Coalition. It's an advocacy group created after September 11th during a rash of attacks against Sikhs who were being confused with Muslims. He says discrimination against Sikhs, many of whom wear turbans, is nothing new.
It is common when it happens on the street. I think it is a little bit less common when it happens on the airwaves, especially here in the United States of America.
New Jersey is home to roughly 100,000 Sikhs. Still, Singh says many people don't know about the religion, and he says that lack of understanding breeds distrust.
Language that promotes intolerance or a lack of willing to understand another community, that leads to divisions, and those divisions can lead into real-world consequences of people being violently assaulted, attacked, even their kids being viciously bullied in schools.
This isn't the first time radio hosts, including those at New Jersey 101.5, have found themselves in hot water. But William Fitzgerald, a professor of rhetoric at Rutgers University, says mainstream American culture no longer tolerates ethnic slurs like it used to.
Once upon a time, you could make ethnic jokes of all sorts, you know, Polish jokes and Italian jokes and so forth. And over time, people have realized that these jokes are truly offensive to various groups in this country and around the world.
The political conversation around immigration in the last few years has rekindled some ethnic hatred, Fitzgerald says, but...
And the bar has gotten lower in the sense that pretty much now no ethnic slur is acceptable.
But not all listeners to the Dennis and Judy show agree. With the pair suspended for 10 days, this morning during the show's normal time slot, a fill-in host opened the phone lines. One caller, John from Pennsylvania, said the hosts were wrong.
Okay, I wish I could be more positive with this phone call saying I support them, but I honestly can't.
But others said outrage over the remarks was overblown, like Victor from Brick.
All this is fake outrage. That's all it is. There's nothing there that Judy said or Dennis said. I mean, I've been called worse names than that when I was a kid.
Here's a caller named Mike from Wall.
But I'd like to know when it became a crime to be offensive to someone. And I'm tired of being a pawn in this game of political correctness.
Still, the pair apologized to Attorney General Grewal and the entire Sikh and East Asian community, saying they'd made a mistake they deeply regret. They'll return to the air in August. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
100 years ago today, a gunshot fired from the window of a South Philadelphia row home sparked one of the worst racial conflicts in the city's history. The fighting grew so bad, at one point the Philadelphia Inquirer called it a race war. Today, the incident is largely forgotten. But as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron reports, the events of 1918 still have strong and fascinating ties to the present.
There's really not much memory living here anymore.
On a recent Tuesday, Temple history professor Ken Finkel stands outside a boarded-up warehouse in Grays Ferry. We're a short walk from the Schuylkill River, standing on what was once contested ground.
You know, there's no evidence that Adela Bond lived here or that a riot started here.
But it did. On July 26, 1918, a white mob surrounded one of the row homes that stood in this western pocket of South Philly. Inside was Adela Bond, a black city worker who'd moved in just 2 days earlier.
She decided to brandish a pistol in order to show she wasn't going to put up with any nonsense. all heck broke loose after that.
In 1918, the face of Philadelphia was changing. With World War I raging overseas, the supply of cheap European labor had dried up, and demand was sky high. America needed workers to build its railroads and run its factories. Documentary filmmaker Louis Messiah says African Americans from the South moved north to fill the void.
That really sparked the beginning of the first Great Migration, which was really the period between the First World War and the start of the Depression in 1929.
Soon, historic black neighborhoods in the eastern part of South Philly were overflowing.
You see African Americans moving further west, west of Broad, and really going all the way, you know, to the Schuylkill area.
Those neighborhoods had traditionally been white, mostly Irish American. Earlier in the summer of 1918, a group of whites attacked two black families in the neighborhood north of Gray's Ferry and burned their furniture. Afterward, G. Grant Williams, editor of the black-owned Philadelphia Tribune, penned a defiant editorial.
He wrote, "You are not in Dixie now, and you need not fear the ragged rum-crazed hellion crew, prototypes of your old cracker enemies." He's saying, and others are agreeing, you know, this is not the South. This is Philadelphia. You can stand up for your rights.
That tension hovered over Gray's Ferry on July 24th, when Adela Bond moved into her new row home on a mostly white block. 2 days later, when the white mob gathered, she fired a warning shot from her second-story window in an effort to alert the police. In the ensuing mayhem, a white man was injured, and the situation quickly escalated.
This is really the first shot in what would be days and days of riots that would close all the saloons and bars and taverns, that would terrorize really one quarter of the city.
Gangs of white men attacked black neighbors and ransacked black homes, and gangs of black men fought back. To quell the violence, hundreds of police flooded the neighborhood and resorted to a familiar tactic.
African-American men were being stopped, frisked. If they had even a penknife, they were arrested.
Over 4 days of fighting, hundreds of people suffered serious injuries, and four men would die. One was a white police officer shot by a black man running from a white mob. A day later, two white police officers arrested and beat a black man named Riley Bullock. They dragged him to the nearest precinct.
Somewhere very quickly after they walked in, the witness, the woman outside the building, heard a shot, and Riley Bullock had been shot in the back.
The bullet pierced Bullock's lungs and killed him. Both officers stood trial but were never convicted of murder. While roughly 60 black men wound up in jail, just three white men were arrested during the riots. Eventually, the violence subsided, and the neighborhood kept changing.
The white were moving out, the black were moving in.
African Americans from the South kept arriving in Gray's Ferry, people like Bufus Outlaw.
I was 14 years old when I came here.
And why did you come?
I wanted to go for a better life.
Born the son of sharecroppers in tiny Wrightsville, Georgia, Outlaw came to Gray's Ferry in 1939. He opened a mechanic shop in 1954 and later a gas station.
I stayed there for 32 years. Middle of Lake Street, my son had called me.
Outlaw is 93 now. He doesn't fix cars anymore, but he still uses that old garage. On weekday afternoons, he and some of the other neighborhood old-timers gather around a plastic picnic table and swap stories over bites of Pringles and McDonald's chicken sandwiches. And from their plastic chairs, they've watched as this now mostly black neighborhood has started to shift.
There are new houses here, and the neighborhood is changing tremendously.
Following roughly the same pattern black residents followed 100 years ago, middle-class white residents have started to filter west across Broad Street. In Gray's Ferry, the signs of gentrification are everywhere, says 83-year-old Theodore Jackson.
You see all these houses they're building, all them new three stories? They're mixed families, but there's a lot of whites coming back. And they speak, walking their dogs, and they love them dogs, you know what I mean?
Bufus Outlaw is right in the middle of these changes. He's about to close a deal to sell this little garage. I ask Theodore Jackson what he'll do when the old shop finally closes for good.
I'm going to put a chair in front of the door here and just stay here and act like I'm still here.
As we're talking, a white woman jogs by with her dog and waves. Jackson taps my shoulder.
You see that lady in the one that was the dog? That's how it is.
In some ways, that's how it's always been. A neighborhood shaped by race and the drumbeat of change. Avi Wolf-Manirant, WHYY News.
Controversy continues to swirl around the Miss America organization in advance of the 92nd Miss America pageant to be held in Atlantic City on September 9th. For perspective, let's bring in Lynn Brile. She was crowned Miss Pennsylvania in 1977 and was a semifinalist in the 1978 Miss America pageant. Lynn, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
You bet. Thank you.
So obviously much of the controversy pertains to the back and forth over the swimsuit segment. In 1977, were organizers or the audience or contestants also up in arms over that aspect of the pageant?
You know, the swimsuit competition was always a controversial part of the competition. You know, it really, that hasn't changed. I think that contestants' attitudes about it may have changed. At the time, it was there was opposition from some women's movements as far as the, you know, really what good is this pageant in terms of, you know, why are we being judged on appearance? I think that I hear good points being made by both sides. Let's look at it this way. You know, I hear a lot of, and I know of contestants who've really had to work hard to reach a goal where maybe it's losing weight or getting more physically fit or getting in shape or in some kind of way they've set a goal for themselves to be able to compete in the bathing suit competition. You know, goal setting is good. I mean, set a goal, reach a goal, that's a life lesson. Now, should that be the only part of the judging and should that be the only criteria? Of course not.
Can you share your recollections of the rigor of preparing for your competitions?
Well, I spent the most time really on the talent part of the competition. At the time, that was most of the weight of the judging was in the talent part of the competition. I was a trained concert pianist, so I spent a lot of time preparing in that way, and I was a preliminary winner in the talent competition. The other thing that I worked on was the judge's face-to-face interview. We didn't have the on-stage questions, thank goodness.
Would you encourage a girl who's considering embarking on this path to do so?
Yes, I would. Certainly, I've seen a lot of really fine young women be given opportunities because of the visibility that the pageant now has. And if they're smart and they're savvy, they're going to turn that experience, no matter, you know, who is critical, they're going to turn this experience into a positive part of their life. And like I said, if they're smart, if they're savvy, they'll use the connections and the network that they built through the Miss America Pageant Organization, and it's easier to do now than it was 40 years ago, to help them in their future.
Conversely, are there any potential pitfalls that you might warn them about?
Yeah, here's what I'd say. You know, it's interesting how the intensity of the competition, from my experience, was less at the Miss America level than it was at the local level. I think that what I would say to young women is that to go into this pageant and this organization, and certainly the Miss America pageant, thinking that, you know, it's a must-win is probably the wrong mindset. Try your hardest. Work your hardest. Set the goal. But understand that, you know, you're being judged by seven people or five people, and it's not going to determine your life path.
I'm still trying to make sense of what you just divulged, that for you, the competition seemed keener at the state level than the national. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, once I got to the Miss America pageant in Atlantic City, I found that the contestants were a lot more, well, realistic about, you know, we're going to enjoy this. It wasn't as cutthroat. They seemed to be a lot more, you know, here I am, I'm going to enjoy this week or this 2 weeks and have a wonderful time. Do my best, of course, but the mindset wasn't as competitive as I found on the state level or even the local level.
Lynn, thanks so much for giving us perspective on Newsworks Tonight.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the chance.
Lynn Brile was crowned Miss Pennsylvania in 1977 and was a semifinalist in the next year's Miss America pageant. As the Philadelphia region has endured a spate of unseasonably rainy days this month, lawmakers have responded on both the state and federal level. Following a tour of central Pennsylvania, which has been hit particularly hard by flooding in recent days, state officials say a number of areas still have high waters and rivers and creeks are dangerously higher than usual. The state's emergency management director, Rick Flynn, says the worst is over, and it's pulled back National Guard teams everywhere except Dauphin County.
A lot of water rescues, a lot of folks driving in high water, which we preach all the time, try not to do that. But since then, the water is receding. We've demobilized.
Wolf says the administration's now looking to get disaster aid from the federal government. Meanwhile, in Washington, South Jersey Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur is claiming a major victory by not allowing other Republicans to let the nation's flood insurance lapse. Details from WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo.
The House is now on summer recess, and one of the last bills they pass keeps the nation's flood insurance program afloat until the fall. The chair of the powerful Financial Services Committee, Jeb Hensarling of Texas, had wanted the program to lapse so that House Republicans could gain leverage on passing reforms to the program in negotiations with the Senate. But South Jersey's Tom MacArthur won out in the end.
So I want to reform it too so the program lasts a long time, but not with a lapse. It leaves people exposed to Mother Nature. It stops the housing market because people can't get mortgages on the shore without flood insurance, so home sales get slammed.
In the meantime, MacArthur wants lawmakers to consider an array of reforms, including protecting homeowners from being liable for massive premium increases and to instill more accountability in FEMA. MacArthur says the House reforms also include bringing the private sector to the table.
I don't want the private market to be a substitute for the flood program because there's not enough interest, but there is enough interest to have the private market take some of this flood risks.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has pledged his colleagues will approve the measure. The House bill extends the flood insurance program until the end of November, which MacArthur says he picked because it takes the program past hurricane season and past the midterm elections. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Summer is the season when those tending the grill for barbecues or picnics are well advised to consider food safety. But who knew breakfast cereal and snack crackers pose a salmonella danger as well? Let's get insight from Martin Bucknavage, Penn State University Senior Food Safety Extension Associate. Martin, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Who knew there was fish in goldfish?
Well, you know, Dave, the risk in goldfish as well as the Ritz crackers is very low. The issue that occurred here was one of the ingredients that was used, the manufacturer of those products, had been tested and found to be positive for salmonella. And, of course, once that happens, the supplier issues a recall to all of the people that they sold the whey powder to, including the manufacturers of the Ritz crackers as well as the goldfish. Now, these manufacturers, of course, are going to go through and bake that product. And in that baking process would probably, under most circumstances, eliminate any salmonella if it had been present.
Granted, but new for many, myself included, to consider that a dry product could have salmonella, which presumably lays dormant for quite a while.
Salmonella can stay in dry products for an extended period of time, and we've seen this in past outbreaks associated with peanut butter, you know, that have very low moisture levels where the salmonella in that product can stay there for long periods of time. You know, however, with a good heating process, that normally will eliminate it.
Overall, though, can we declare that there are more incidents of food poisoning than before?
I think one of the things that we've seen is the fact that our ability to test and determine the outbreak sources has become so much better than it was years ago, that we see a lot more of these outbreaks occurring where we didn't see before. So if we had illnesses in 3 or 4 or even 5 different states and with a couple cases here and there, we wouldn't be able to know what the product was and the fact that these were actually the same organism. But our technology has gotten so much better that we can go through and match these outbreak strains down to the DNA level and say, oh, this is the same outbreak. Now, I think one of the things that this has done is it's really helped to create a safer food supply, because we can go through and identify these things and eliminate them, maybe where we couldn't do that 20 years ago.
Nonetheless, the CDC declares that foodborne illness hits roughly 1 in 6 Americans every year. Salmonella isn't the only villain. There are apparently dozens of pathogens. Is salmonella among the most virulent, though?
I think the problem with salmonella is the fact that it is so prevalent within our environment. It's carried by a number of different birds. It's carried by reptiles. And because of that, it has the ability to get onto and into a number of different areas. You know, if you have birds flying around and pooping on your picnic table, or, you know, with different types of crops, if there should happen to be some contamination that gets onto tomatoes or even in grain products like flour, you know, the salmonella could be there. And as we just said, it can stay in this dry state for a long period of time.
Of course, we rely on guidelines established by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. But so much food comes in from out of the country. Should consumers be cautious?
I think anything that comes into the United States is supposed to meet the same standards as product that's produced here, and certainly a lot of our recent regulations that have been enacted help to ensure that that's going to be the case. You know, if you're going to the supermarket and you're going to buy fruits or vegetables or you're going to buy seafood, there's a high probability that that came from overseas or from a different country. So to really start to look at and avoid that, I think would be pretty difficult. I think it's more important to make sure that people practice the proper handling and preparation procedures, including, you know, washing fruits and vegetables, cooking food to the proper temperature, washing your hands. A lot of those things are going to go a lot further in terms of having safe food.
If a produce item has contamination, or seafood or meat or poultry, does cooking it sufficiently kill off the bacteria?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you cook hamburger to the proper temperature of 160 degrees Fahrenheit, if you cook poultry to 165 degrees Fahrenheit, those temperatures, you know, have been shown to eliminate pathogens such as salmonella.
Thanks for offering the tips, and thanks for imparting knowledge on the topic.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Martin Bucknavage, Penn State University Senior Food Safety Extension Associate on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.